Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Effects. Welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you here. And on this, the 10th day of January, 10th day of 2016, it only leaves us with 355 days left. Unbelievable. But as you can imagine, time moves on. Time waits for nobody. So don't be impatient. Things are changing around us. The March equinox is coming up. This is already the 10th of January. It's coming up on the 20th of March this year at 4:31. So don't be too. That's going to be 12:31 a.m. in here where I am in the world. That only leaves us with how many days? Yeah, 69 days till the March equinox. 69 days, 15 hours. So if you're inclined to celebrate those types of things, there you have it. Easter this year is coming up really early as well. So that fluctuates, as you know, around the lunar calendar. It's a throwback to earlier days, to earlier calculations, to different calendars. But it's coming up in March, on the 27th. So just a few days after the equinox, you're going to be seeing things change for people who are of the faith, whether you're part of the organized religions or not. It's really what's in your heart. Today we have an interesting program. I've been, and I do need your help. But before I do that, I want to thank you all for your unwavering support. It's been remarkable, particularly you fellows from the UK. I'm welcoming you with open arms. We're moving into the sixth year of Masonic Effects. Originally, for many years, until last year, it was Masonic Home Companion, And so we're quite pleased to know that there has been appeal out there, and I understand that we're being more widely the program is being more widely spread than we can really calculate here at this end on our stats and monitoring, but we have some acknowledgements to make. This program is not, I think, as common to Freemasonry, and I think it speaks to a very select audience of Mason. I want to embolden you and to encourage all of those who have felt that there is so much more potential to the order than what we see around lodges. It's not a simple process in lodges and districts. But we have a changing landscape around us. And in order for Freemasonry to handle some of the challenges, first we need to be clear and agree on what those challenges are. And I don't think we've exactly done that. I want to say in all candor that our collective grand lodges need to almost stay out of the fray. Our grand, the grand masters represent every Mason in that jurisdiction. They need to be above and beyond any type of controversy, because at the end of the day, they are the head of our organization, the symbol of Masonry, the embodiment of it. So if you're ever noticing, of course, that their role is particularly symbolic, well, you'd be, I think, in good company with that opinion, because of this very, very interesting phenomena and sense of responsibility. That comes from generations of awareness. Now, one Grand Master to another, to another, to another, or what we know as the Grand East. It is important that they preserve that role for all of us and for the future of Masonry, if they are a connection with our past. And although some are drawn into, you know, it's so tempting for us today to be drawn into different conversations, and particularly with the expectation that we're in a country that is not as familiar with social stratification as many places in Europe. And I'm in a very young nation here in Canada, and we're learning quickly, but there are things that we have, there are much more interesting things for us to come, both in terms of the social contract and particularly the future of Masonry is even more audacious and glowing than this country. So I think it's an amazing combination. The future holds such great promise. Now, that said, I need to be able to speak very candidly about some things that I've noticed, and I need your help with that. So all of you listeners need your advice and help. I'll give you commentary that I hope is thoughtful and interesting and informative and entertaining. But it's really for you to not sit back and just agree with everything that goes on here. Of course, that would be a bit soft a mark, but to think it through for yourself. And to, if you're going to make a comment, do it in a thoughtful and well-informed manner. The work that we do here in Masonic Effects is intended to be inclusive, that the whatever adaptations and changes that there and adjustments that are made in the day-to-day function of Masonry, it's vitally important that we remain inclusive. So, if that's it, if there are thin-skinned members who feel that anything unfamiliar is intolerable, then we're probably going to watch them. They're probably, I'm thinking, looking for a reason to head out the door, and this will be, sadly, a good reason. However, I would appeal to their better nature, to their curiosity, that Masonry is never quite as it appears. There's always more dimensions to it. And we want to peel back some of the, pull back some of the curtains and examine what's been going on. Now, I'm going to talk to you today about sort of launching myself in a few different interesting directions here Masonically, but let's start with a commentary, and then I'll play you some, I think, an interesting collection of music today, from a recorder music to French Baroque and even Chopin and Haydn and Vivaldi. I believe that the order was designed around an amazing idea. An idea that it was a learned society, an offshoot of the Royal Society, in some ways, at least the organization as we know it today. We do know that the earliest extant records of Freemasonry are in Scotland, from 16th century. So it well precludes anything going on in England, of course. But the idea of a learned conversation was perhaps formulating in England, but it wasn't necessarily. It's like, remember the silliness that went on in the 50s and 60s about the so-called superpowers competing for who invented air, and who was first and who was biggest. Well, my goodness, we've moved beyond that. Today, at the Hadron Collider, the Large Hadron Collider and a particle collider in Switzerland, we have physicists from over 100 nations working together one of the most major scientific processes that's ever been conducted by mankind. And believe it or not, there's no necessary commercial application, nor is there any military application. Hard to believe that we as a race are capable of working collectively, but here is a benchmark. This is a moment in our history where we are looking for the particle from the very start to help us to understand everything that came afterwards. And this is both theoretical and experimental. And so the globe needs to be, we need to be able to sit up from the pain and disgrace of war, and to acknowledge the what happens when bright minds work together and resources are made available. But I digress. Here's our commentary for today: is the essentials of understanding Masonic adjustment. Have we actually had a fall from grace? If we have, it has left Freemasonry not as icon, but relic. We have let the mirror of time hide an enriched philosophical environment behind a dusty mantle. If we read the opinions of Freemasonry over the centuries, we quickly realize this observation is not new. By 1740, the idea of being a doppelganger of the Royal Society had already fallen out of favor. It is difficult to imagine that idea has such gravitas that the drift away from the appeal of thoughtful, meaningful discussion has carried us 300 years down the road before this period of market adjustment is in some ways forcing us to rethink what this means to our future. We are way past the problems of being thin-skinned and muscular in defense of our status quo. The ice is already cracking underfoot. But something needs to be said about changing the narrative and making adjustments inclusive of our fraternal principles. We lose ground every time buffoonery goes unchallenged. Here in Canada, we are known for our good manners and friendliness. We are tolerant, quiet managers of change. These are the traits needed most to help our fraternity and our grand lodges. Many of the sources we drew upon to replenish the order are gone. Migration from country to city has accelerated. Economics require most young couples to both work. Retirement savings are being wiped out by global banking trends. Women are equals in form but are paid substandard wage. Owning a house is a dream many couples will never achieve. Today, marriage is not expected. Divorce is. We are living longer and becoming dependent on others. And Canada has grown into a multicultural country where we want newcomers to learn our languages and accept the culture of Canada. The good life still requires self-sacrifice and effort. It is about preserving three essential ideas. We cannot live as yesterday, and we can adjust. We must. Now, listen to something thoughtful. Something that give you us a second to catch our breath here, the program, and get on with the show. This is from Neil Gow's Lament. What a writer does when what a composer does when his wife dies. Writes music as a memory. A learned society. Can you imagine anybody being more impressed with a term than learned society? We want to believe that every person has the ability to expand their horizon by replacing superstition, replacing outdated ideas with notions that are consistent with the latest findings, with the latest that we can work with. Now, the absolute people that have an absolute frame of reference, that are looking for ultimate truths, often they wouldn't know an ultimate truth if it ran over them in a field. The poor things know the idea and the concept. But today, it's traded carbon surpluses are being traded. It's an abstraction. But imagine the appeal of something, as I said in the commentary, that lasted, even though it was tedious, for the first couple of years, you know, for a long time. It held things together. It was a mortar in between the stones that held the attention, and this was not against a background of the weight of history that you and I face every day, in Masonic terms. The provinces weren't developed. The degree work wasn't developed as it is today. And fellows, we know, felt more comfortable and were more willing to invest their time in a good time. So particularly around from, and it's simply because of documentation, we know a great deal about how the lodges functioned. Even to this day, when you look at the record books, there's very little written about the quality of the experience of the meeting. Very, very little. Next to nothing. That's been really stripped out of the minute books. What we hear is about the business of a lodge, the cost, more about the food and drink that's available, and the price of and the bills, as if that's all that there is meeting after meeting. We couldn't expect, if we're that tedious and that boring, we couldn't expect to hold ourselves up against a framework of any kind of learned society. Not really. There's no content to it. Where's the learned part? The discussions are, you know, those add-ons at the end of them or injected, which are held with great impatience. Well, back in the early part of the 18th century, this was a trend that had already been going on. Let's have a meal. Let's have some drinks. Let's open lodge. Let's close lodge. Let's have some drinks and camaraderie. And you can see how long back there would always be those who thought the original idea had great merit, that held that curiosity, not for life in general, but what this group was offering when they were talking about a learned society. How would they define this? How is this being portrayed? And the notion that you could only benefit from being in the company of thinkers, you know, has appeal, but not to everybody. Over the years in Masonry, I've heard this pathetically referred to as BS. You hear these people, that's the standard. Now, is it taken seriously? Well, not so much. There's a mawkishness to that kind of an attitude. But we trade on that. We've traded on that for a long, long time because it increases members, it increases and replenishes us. But as we point out here today in the commentary, our sources of people to replenish us has shifted. And we would be wise to shift with that, to stay on top of what's going on in our environment, because obviously we haven't. It's not so important to consider why, I think. For some, it will be. We have new sciences today that weren't in existence in the 16th and 17th century. And one would think that a group of bright fellows would be using all of science. Internal reflection, psychology, that wasn't available, wasn't nearly as developed. And if you're making the stretch back to the early suppositions of Aristotle and Galen, and well, my goodness, you're not exactly bringing us into the wheelhouse of the 21st century. We have gone beyond postmodernism now in our philosophical thought. We are into a new tunneling. I want you to examine, if you're going to sit down and you haven't seen people for a long time, and your life was predictable, that the science around you was simple, clearer, perhaps more ruthless, that superstition played a greater role, that we had the Magna Carta, but we hadn't had it translated and interpreted into a meaningful law. So we were left with a sense of common law and natural law. Now, when you get together, you would make the occasion important, because it was special. Remember, I'm a fellow that as a boy was dressed up in his finest to go to see the doctor. Mm-hmm. That church wasn't done in a golf shirt and slacks. It was done with a tie and a pressed shirt and little suit, polished shoes. It showed respect. And there was some sense of order. Now, whether good or bad, there's no valence to the passage of time. It is what it is. So things have evolved. It was a different era of perhaps blinder trust than we could have today. A different kind of trust in institutions that history has revealed to be unworthy of that faith. So we are a more cautious, well-informed group. Thank goodness. We haven't given up anything except that innocence that perhaps we wanted to preserve as much as we possibly could. In Canada, we're still struggling to preserve our innocence, and we're being brought into the reality of the world closing in around us as the global community connects. But a learned society, thoughtful discussion, I'm pretty sure that our ancient brethren would have wanted it as the same as we would today. Now, today we live in relative access. We have access like we've never had before, access to one another and access to ideas. And it's like I keep being reminded of the thought of Christmas every day. If we had Christmas every day, like when you were a child, what would you dream of? Christmas every day, it would lose all its meaning. It wouldn't be special. It would be just another day. Well, I think that's what's happened with Freemasonry. Just another day. Just another meeting. We've become weary. We're tired of the humdrum. The specialness, the efforts to make things special, are hard to hold together year by year, decade by decade. And then the appeal to draw people in and expect them to be tolerant of this is, I think, a little bit of an imposition on anybody. It's an idea that's wanting. So, in fact, I think it's an erroneous assumption. Because anybody at any time should be able to expect that in exchange for the membership is the responsibility of the organization to educate. Well, there's the devil in the details, as we say. Here, listen to this. This is from Tim Berners-Lee, 1999. One of the beautiful things about physics is its ongoing quest to find simple rules that describe the behavior of very small, simple objects. Once found, these rules can often be scaled up to describe the behavior of monumental systems in the real world. This is from the prologue of Freemasonry and the Birth of Modern Science. It's written by Robert Lomas. And it's a book that I highly recommend. The tall, gaunt man walked over to the window and looked out. The previous night had been bitterly cold, and the lawns at the side of his apartment were white with hoarfrost. Using what warmth there was in his coarse soldier's hands, he melted the ice from inside the casement and looked out east, across the privy gardens toward the cluttered roofs of the palace. The dull gray glow of the low winter sun as it struggled to climb over the horizon was giving little hope of anything but an overcast winter's day. Still, he thought, perhaps the rain would hold off a little while. He wasn't in bad shape for a 52-year-old. He tried to keep himself fit and active. He looked toward the sundial, which he had recently constructed for the king in the center of the lawns. But the light was too diffuse for it to cast any shadow. As he stood shivering in the winter's chill of that November morning, he thought about the meeting he had to arrange for the coming afternoon. Was he taking too great a risk in bringing together this group of men who had been sworn enemies for so long? Would the bonds of a common single interest be enough to persuade these men who had all suffered so much during the recent war to sit down together and talk? Was he hoping for too much in trying to persuade them to work together in harmony, to support the newly restored king? He shook his head to clear his thoughts. A good soldier prepares his battle strategy before the onslaught begins, and this man was a good soldier. He knew that it is better to capture an enemy army entire rather than destroy it. He was aware that to fight, to conquer, and then to destroy his old enemies would not help him to achieve his aims. He needed to break their resistance without fighting. Now was the time to apply the hard lessons he learned during the years he had spent as quartermaster general, civil engineer and spy in the armies of Scotland and France. He not only had to persuade his longtime antagonists to work with him, but he somehow had to make them believe that it was their own idea to do so. How could he do this? Perhaps he could persuade one of the more extreme members of the opposition to chair the meeting. Who, he wondered, had the most to gain? Certainly the man who had lost the most was Wilkins. He remembered overhearing the garrulous young clerk of Lord Montague's prattling on earlier in the week. He was telling how Wilkins, the deposed master of Trinity College and once favored brother-in-law to Cromwell himself, was now reduced to preaching for coppers. This ex-warden of Wardham College was struggling to live, crammed into the squalid lodging of yet another despotic cleric, and was reduced to acting as a chaplain for the penny-pinching lawyers of Gray's Inn. Wilkins presented such a sorry spectacle that he was beginning to attract voyeurs to the Temple Church, just to marvel at the extent to which the family of the late Lord Protector could be humiliated. Yes, Wilkins would be flattered to be asked to chair the meeting. Indeed, if it was put to him in the right way, he would accept it as nothing less than his right. That was the way to present it, play to the man's vanity. Diplomatic skills learned in the service of the French had their uses, even in the uncertain world of Restoration England. So we know here, we're talking about a time after the Civil Wars, after the beheading of Charles I, 1610, and Charles II, his son, taking the throne. The clatter of horses' hooves and the rattle of a carriage stopping in the gateway just below his rooms drew him back from his reverie. Enough planning and scheming, the time for action had come. The king himself was forewarned. The king's supporters would already be setting off toward Bishopsgate. All that was left to do was to persuade able men, almost destroyed by the bloody events of the Civil War, to work with him. He felt his mouth go dry at the anticipation of the task. But if Britain was to survive the threat from the Dutch, he must succeed. He took a deep breath and turned away from the window. Sir Robert Moray knew what had to be done, and he knew how he intended to do it. He dressed carefully, donning the somber black clothes he had favored since the death of his wife. Was it almost 10 years since she had passed away? He set off across the privy lawns toward the stone steps that led to the Thames. Catching a sculler by the riverside, he paid his sixpence to be ferried upriver, almost to the Tower. And there he disembarked to walk through the narrow, cluttered, reeking streets of Bishopsgate to the quiet haven of Gresham College. After listening to a lecture on astronomy from Christopher Wren, Sir Robert Moray went back to the rooms of Lawrence Rooke, to the meeting he had been thinking about for so long. The day was Wednesday, 28 November, 1616. We don't really know what he thought and felt that cold November morning, but I know the results. That afternoon, he created modern science. So far, this introduction has been pure speculation, but it is speculation based on fact. The man I have just described is a lost hero of science. He is responsible for the remarkable development in scientific innovation that has taken place over the last 400 years. And this book is the story of my personal quest to understand what he did and why he did it. As a young scientist, I learned that one of the highest honors to which a member of the scientific community could aspire was to become a fellow of the Royal Society. This is the oldest and most respected scientific society in the world. Its early members' names living on amid the physics I was studying. Looking down the list of new members was like reading the index of a textbook. Hooke's Law, Boyle's Law, Huygens' Construction, Newton's Law, Leibniz's theorem, Brownian motion, and this is ignoring lesser scientists such as Christopher Wren, John Evelyn, John Wilkins, Elias Ashmole, John Flamsteed, and Edmund Halley. But the men who founded this society were not just the first scientists, they were also the last sorcerers. Ashmole actually belonged to a society of Rosicrucians and was a practicing astrologer. Newton studied and wrote about the Rosicrucian concepts of alchemy, while Hooke carried out magical experiments involving spiders and unicorns' horns. The Rosicrucians, who took their name from their symbol of a rosy cross, taught about the magical harmony of the spheres, which indirectly affected the harmony of the world. This ethereal music emitted strange, unseen cosmic forces that affected the destiny of humans, and its consequences could be foretold from the positions of the stars in the heavens. Rosicrucians also believed that fire could be used as a universal means of analysis of the nature of matter, and in the right circumstances could turn base metals into gold. However, they also claimed to be able to hold conversations with demons and angels. Not many of today's leading scientists would admit to such pursuits. So what inspired an unlikely group of refugees from both sides of the Civil War to meet, form the world's oldest and most respected scientific society, and then go on to develop the tools of modern science? This was the question which started me off on this quest to understand how the Royal Society came to be formed. I wanted to know where this mixture of clergymen and politicians got the idea of forbidding the discussion of religion and politics at their meetings. In an age dominated by politics and religion, it seemed a weird thing to do. I couldn't avoid confronting these questions when I first read about the puzzling circumstances of this world-changing event. With the hindsight inbred by a scientific education, it seemed inevitable that the logic of science should succeed in banishing myth and superstition. In 1660, however, this outcome was not so certain. Now, the question we want to leave you with was, did the start of this have anything to do with Masonic relationships? That's the old book. What do you think? What was the catalyst? Something in the background? Something about the relationships of these men? A little Baroque. My favorite genre.
Oh.
early French folk songs. From the Chateau of Chambord, around the time. Let me think that here, the ideas of the period of the development of the Royal Society was not standalone. There were influences and forces that created a moment in history in a particular spot in the lives of a group of very unusual men. Now, could those circumstances be recreated? And if we were successful to create those circumstances, would we produce a similar outcome? I'd say those same circumstances cannot. History and time has moved us on. We wouldn't be starting a royal society. That's already been done. But the idea of bringing together thoughtful men for discussion, for development of the mind, that can be replicated time and time again. I don't think it needs to be said that if something is going to be special, it has to be treated as a unique event and made special by the people organizing it. That if we think of things in a dogmatic way, that if we do it once and there's an interest, then we just do it the same way forever, I think is really lacking a certain je ne sais quoi, lacking a certain sense of innovation. But it wasn't that long ago when the man who put on the first gallery of post-impressionist art during the early start of the 20th century was wildly criticized and vilified in Paris. There was even some thought that he should be admitted to an asylum. Can you imagine? Of course, this was a time when painters were pushing the boundaries of the mind, the boundaries of expectations, and some of the work was an affront because it created exactly what the painters wanted. They wanted a reaction. And to this day, their work still is able to draw a reaction. And yet, in order to understand that, one needs to appreciate the context of what they were doing. And arrive at these, again, points in time. Now, will we be able to repeat the Impressionist movement? Well, that's already been done. Will there be a new form of art? Yeah. Do we necessarily know what it is? No. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be wonderful and rewarding and significant. But we need to keep an open mind. I was going to talk a bit about poetry today, but I realized that it's probably a good time to talk about it tomorrow. And I remember David Schimmelpenninck van der Rohe, professor of history at Brock University, had reminded me, he's just one of those delightful conversations you have with the man, about Tatiana Day. That's observed on the 25th of January, according to the Gregorian calendar. And if you're an advocate of the Julian, it happens on the 12th of January. And it's named after a Christian martyr in 3rd century Rome during the reign of Severus, the Saint Tatiana. This is a day when all of the students celebrated as Russian Students' Day. And it's been a long tradition of festive activities. In 1885, the Russian writer Chekhov wrote, This year, everything was drunk except the water from the Moscow River, and only because it was frozen. Parties begin with a traditional honey-based mead. Although originating in Moscow, St. Tatiana's Day celebrations have spread to most university towns. And coincidentally, the 25th of January is also the end of the first term of the traditional academic year for Russian students. The end of winter exams session, followed by a two-week winter holiday. So, congratulations to all of Russian students on the completion of their first term. We wish you all the best as you move forward in your academic program. And the 25th, it's coming up. So, think of this group on the 25th of January, celebrating, just as young minds have always done, breaking the rules of propriety to do it. And I was going to talk about a bit about the poetry of Alfred Lord Tennyson, and then it reminded me that we should need to be perhaps a little more mindful of what's going on here at home. This is just recently, just a couple of days ago, George Eliot Clark, he's a Nova Scotian writer, and he was named the country's 7th Parliamentary Poet Laureate. And he, this is a one-year gig, and this was, the Parliamentary, Canadian Parliamentary Poet Laureate is the official Poet Laureate for Canada. And this is a position of the Office of the Library of Canada, so it is a parliamentary position. And this was only started in 2001 to draw Canadians' attention to spoken and written poetry and its role in our lives. So again, Canada being young, we've just recently, this is only, 15 years in? So this is not long. And the position comes with an annual stipend. Very, very modest, like $20,000, you know, and some travel money on top of that. Very, very modest. And the laureate serves at the pleasure of both the Speaker of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Commons. The maximum term of office is set at 2 years. So we've had George Bowring, Pauline Michel, John Steffler, Pierre de Rissot, Fred Waugh, Michel Pleu, and now George Eliot Clark. So this is, so that's, so you know, this is a career for Mr. Clark. Lives in Toronto and began teaching Canadian and African diasporic literature in 1999 at the University of Toronto. And he's on a second volume of essays on African-Canadian literature. In the later shows, we'll bring in some material by our poet laureate so that at least we can have a sample and determine for ourselves. What got me into that was wanting to bring you some quotes from Alfred Lord Tennyson. And I thought, this just seemed somehow wrong that I would be honoring a poet laureate of Great Britain and Ireland during much of Queen Victoria's reign and not be able to tell you who the poet laureate is for Canada. It just seemed enormously, enormously wrong. Now, Tennyson, we can quote. I think it's safe. Hope smiles from the threshold of the year to come, whispering, it will be happier. He said, hope smiles. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. That's him. Shape your heart to front the hour, but dream not that the hours will last. It changes. Enjoy what we have while we have it. A smile abroad is often a scowl at home. The happiness of a man in this life does not consist in the absence, but in the mastery of his passions. No man ever got high by pulling other people down. The intelligent merchant does not knock his competitors. The sensible worker does not work those who work with him. Don't knock your friends. Don't knock your enemies. Don't knock yourself. All experience is an arch, wherethrough gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. We have to wrap up the program. You've had recorder a lament to the composer's dead wife. We've had French Baroque folk music sung on a broader scale. Little taste of Chopin, but I want to beg your indulgence just for a second to talk about Freemasons and the future when we come back. This is from Chopin's Fantasy by Frédéric Chopin, Impromptu. Delightful. Thank you. taste. Sorry, I had to cut that off just a few bars before the ending. That's Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu. Dig it out. It's beautiful, beautiful way of listening. Not to be doom and gloom about the order, but we need to be smarter about the way we go about conducting ourselves. We've been very modest. Secret societies began to grow out of fashion after World War II. And the ones that did survive concentrated on becoming social clubs or service organizations. Freemasonry began to play down its esoteric aspects and play up its fish fries and bake sales and bean suppers and card nights. And lodges became little more than welcome mats for members who really wanted to become Shriners. Somewhere in the transformation, some of the mystique was lost in favor of openness, practicality, and serving up a really good bowl of chili. Even Freemasonry's nemesis, the Catholic Church, while still forbidding parishioners from becoming Masons, admitted in recent opinions that the garden variety of Freemasonry practiced in the United States was mostly harmless. This is from the work of Christopher Hodapp in his Freemasonry for Dummies. Mostly harmless. The public spotlight for popular references and the internet has started to shine a little stronger on Freemasonry. Giant membership growth in the 50s also meant a giant loss in the 21st century as those older members die. But those numbers are tapering off. A new generation of men is joining the fraternity, but what they are finding in most lodges is not the Masonry they studied about before joining. A lot walk away. Others are staying behind and making changes to see to it that Freemasonry remains the biggest, best, and oldest fraternity of gentlemen. There is a future to the craft. Freemasonry has been shrinking for a while, and lodges have been panicking. Massive buildings that were built during the boom years are now in danger of closing. Lodges that have been around for 100 years or more are emerging or simply dying. The big membership boom of the 50s was also a curse, because the big swell of new Masons then has meant the unfortunate deaths of record numbers of these same men now. And the baby boomers didn't join. No shortage of long-faced, sour-pussed articles about Freemasonry's impending death march to the tar pits has been making the rounds of the internet for a decade. The good news is that Freemasonry isn't dead, he says. It just smells funny. About the mid-1990s, local lodges began shrieking for help. Members were dying and were not being replaced by new men. Something had to be done, even if they didn't know exactly what that something should be. So Grand Lodges stepped up to the plate with some controversial answers. If numbers were the problem, there were ways to get them in the door. Taking a cue from the way the degrees of the Scottish Rite are conferred to many candidates sitting in an auditorium, Grand Lodges began to permit the entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason degrees to be conferred on a large scale to many men at one time, in a single day. An exemplar candidate went through the ritual ceremonies on stage while the rest of the candidates watched. In an effort to make them even more popular, some Grand Lodges cooperated with the Scottish Rite and shrine groups in their jurisdiction, making it possible for a man to walk into the auditorium at sunrise as a non-Mason and become a third-degree Mason, a 32nd-degree Scottish Rite Mason, and a Shriner by sunset. These all the way in one day or sidewalk to shrine events have been controversial, to say the least. Many members believe they are an appalling development. and they frequently complain of these events cranking out one-day wonders or McMasons. Many foreign jurisdictions are outraged by the practice, and there have been rumblings about the possibility of suspending recognition of Grand Lodges who allow it. Desperate? Does it sound desperate? It does, doesn't it? Let it all go. Come back and join us next week. It's desperate, but it's not. We're regaining the ground that was lost, if we can put it that way. There's opinions, but what's most important is that we have work to do. And the audience of Masonic Effects, I think, is a part of that work. I hope you enjoyed the program today. And I look forward to having you join us again soon. In the meantime, commit those acts of random kindness in true Masonic fashion. Bye for now.